Industry is charged fees or levies, All are non-secretary schemes with participation determined by the respective industry funds. All have the necessary industry expertise and the necessary qualified staff. Each ombud has a clearly defined jurisdiction. All offer services free of charge to consumers. All subscribe to principles of fairness, independence, accountability and accessibility, as well as impartiality. All enjoy equity jurisdiction, i.e., that is, the outcomes of any decision are not limited to determinations based solely on legal principles. Other factors are also taken into account. All of them have the power to make determinations that are binding on the industry. All are answerable to the independent boards and not to the industry. Okay, what does each ombud do? The Ombudsman for the Long-Term Insurance, the current Ombudsman, Judge Ron McCarran, was established in 1985. The industry that it serves is the long-term insurance industry. Its jurisdiction relates to complaints against subscribing members about long-term insurance policies. In 2015, it dealt with a total case of 4,534. The Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance, the current Ombudsman, Advocate Ian Wood, was new in that post. The Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance was established in August 1989. It serves the short-term insurance industry, and it deals with issues relating to insurance in terms of motor, homeowners, which is buildings, householders, which includes content, cell phones, travel, disability, credit protection insurance, and in some instances commercial insurance on a limited basis, depending on the turnover of a juristic person or a partnership, which must be not less than $25 million. In the year 2015, they dealt with approximately 10,000 cases. The Ombudsman for Banking Services, the current Ombudsman Advocate Clive Pillay, established in 1997, it served the banking industry, and it resolved individual complaints about banking services and products. Any bank customer who has a complaint against the deal of a bank may approach the Ombudsman for Banking Services for assistance. In 2015, it opened 5,021 cases, and it closed 4,899. The Credit Ombudsman, current Ombudsman, it's me, we were established in 2004. We serve two industries, the credit bureau industry and all their subscribers, as well as the non-bank credit industry, that is retail furniture, clothing, micro-lending, non-bank motor and home finances. We deal with non-bank credit because banking credit goes to the banking office. We have a jurisdiction to resolve complaints from consumers and businesses that are negatively impacted by credit bureau information or consumers' disputes with their credit providers in terms of their credit contracts. Last year, we dealt with 5,074 cases. Okay, we'd like to go into the comments on the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, more particularly Chapter 14 on the Ombuds. Firstly, we fully support the proposal that's contained in the bill. We do, however, have the following comments to make and set out suggestions regarding the clarification of certain matters and the improvement of some sections. Prior to the current bill that you have before you, there was a draft bill, a 2014 draft bill, which came out or dated 10th of December 2014. When we looked at that bill, we thought that there were certain things that should have been retained and going forward into this new bill with the necessary adjustments. And these are the following. The preamble to that 2014 bill contains the following objectives. To require financial product and financial service providers to members of or to be covered by appropriate ombud scheme. This is contained in the preamble of the 2014 bill. It appears to us to be an oversight that the bill does not contain a section which gives effect to the purpose expressed in the preamble, and such section should be included. We suggest that the wording of the 2014 bill be included. Furthermore, the definition of an industry on the scheme. This definition should include an exclusion from its ambit of internal complaints resolution arrangements established by financial institutions. Many of the financial institutions, banks and credit providers, in a certain sense, has an internal complaint handling system, and they can also be referred to as the internal ombuds. We suggest that that definition should exclude that from the ambit of this law. Then, in that sections, various sections, and I quote them, 190.12b, section 192.2, and section 195.2.1.2 and 5 of 2014 both should be retained. For ease of reference, we set about what all of those contain. Section 191 sets out the jurisdiction of the different ombuds. And we cut the wording of the 2014 vote below for ease of reference. Section 191 states, the ombuds referred to in this Act have the following jurisdiction. The adjudicator and ombuds for financial service providers have jurisdiction as set out in the respective provisions of this Act. An ombud of a recognized scheme has the jurisdiction provided by the terms which govern the operation of the scheme and the terms of reference of the ombud, and statutory ombud has jurisdiction in respect of matters contemplated in Section 191. In terms of Section 192b, there is an obligation on an ombud's office to send complaints that fall within the jurisdiction of another ombud's office to that office. Once again, we quote the relevant section as contained in the 2014 Bill 192, and it states, if an ombud for recognized scheme, the adjudicator, or the ombud for financial service providers does not have jurisdiction in respect of a specific complaint, that ombud, adjudicator, or ombud for financial service providers must submit the complaint without undue delay to the ombud of a scheme which does have jurisdiction, or the council if the matter falls within the jurisdiction of the statutory ombuds and must advise the financial customer accordingly. Section 192.2, the right of complainant to seek legal redress are not affected by the vote. No provision of the Act affects any right of the financial customer or other affected person to seek appropriate legal redress. By virtue of the common law or statutory law before or after the consideration of a complaint by an ombud. Section 195.1 states that financial institutions cannot participate in ombud schemes that are not recognized. Section 195.2, such participation is null and void, and 195.1 goes into various prohibitions and exemptions. Similarly, 195.5, financial institutions cannot use terminology for in-house complaint handling arrangements that give the impression that it is an ombud scheme. And once again, we set out 195.5 in terms of what is contained in the 2014 law. Also, Section 10.1e of the Financial Services Ombud Scheme requires an industry scheme to apply principles of equity. We do not regard Sections 174 and 199.1 of the current bill as giving sufficient recognition to this principle. Subsection 2A in terms of 194 states that the Ombud Regulatory Council must not recognize an industry ombud scheme unless satisfied that a significant number of relevant financial institutions are or shall on the industry ombud schemes being recognized in members of the industry ombud scheme. The reference to a significant number of relevant financial institutions is vague and open to different interpretations. We recommend that the reference should be to a significant number of relevant financial institutions based on asset value, gross income, or financial customer base, as the Ombud Regulatory Council may determine in general or in a particular instance. In a particular category of financial institutions are or shall. Also, subsection 2b2 should be tidied up and should read, make adequate and appropriate provision for consumers to lodge complaints instead of making complaints. Section 194 of the Covenant Bull, determination of applications continued. The governing body of an ombuds scheme is defined as being the person or body of persons that manage the affairs of the ombuds scheme. The provisions of Section 194.2b.3 are compatible with the definition of governing by a body. It may be that the references to a committee in Section 194.2b.6 and 7 are errors, and that the references should have been to a governing body. The only members of the ombuds scheme are companies and not individuals. As Section 194.2b.6 currently reads, it prohibits a company from serving on a governing body. However, individuals and not companies serve on governing bodies. Section 194.3 gives a non-response from the Ombuds Regulatory Council after 3 months to be a refusal to recognize the scheme. It is suggested that that subsection 3 be deleted, as it appears to us to offend against administrative justice, as it removes accountability for proper decision-making and giving reasons for a refusal. Suspension of recognition, Section 196. 196.1c also broadly refers to if a significant number of financial institutions that are members of the Ombuds Ombuds Scheme and the reference to Ombuds therein appears to be an error. The reference to if a significant number of financial institutions that are members could be problematic, as the Ombuds for the Industry Ombuds Scheme had no control over the business practice of financial institutions and could be held accountable for their, that is, financial institutions' actions by the role of recognition of the scheme. This provision seems to be inappropriate. If the financial institutions contravene the law, regulatory action should be directed against them and not the ombuds scheme. Section 199, the rules of the Ombuds Regulatory Council. We suggest that any rule made by the Ombuds Regulatory Council should be done in consultation with the relevant ombudsman or ombudsman scheme. Section 199.4 provides that no rule of the Ombuds Regulatory Council may interfere with the independence of an ombuds or the investigation or determination of a specific complaint. The above section empowers the Ombuds Regulatory Council to make rules in relation to dispute resolution processes, in other words, to prescribe how a complaint should be resolved. We believe that Section 199.2e thus impinges on the independence of an ombudsman and suggests that it should be deleted. Section 201, brackets, directive of the Ombuds Regulatory Council, and Section 203, debarment. Section 201 refers to a financial sector ombuds scheme, which is not defined, it's not a defined term. Instead, it should refer to an industry ombuds scheme as defined. Section 203.9 states that an ombuds scheme that becomes aware that a debarment order has been made in respect of an individual employed or engaged by the ombuds scheme must take all reasonable steps to ensure that the order is still in effect. We question the need to debar an individual employed or engaged by the ombuds scheme, but this can be dealt with by the ombudsman himself or herself. Section 26 ombuds scheme. Generally, cross-referencing of the various sections quoted therein is not correct, as it refers to inappropriate sections and should be corrected. Furthermore, the penalties and sentences for any offence should be appropriate. The proposed fine and sentences seem excessive and should be reconsidered. So that is our comments in respect of the financial sector regulation board. But we also like to take you through the current objectives and initiatives undertaken by the voluntary ombuds scheme. The various ombuds have embarked on initiatives to bring the scheme in line with international trends and best practices. The four offices meet regularly, and working together, they focus on the following aspects. Promotion of greater awareness among consumers about ombuds schemes. Targeted consumer education through radio, television interviews, seminars, press releases, and publications. Interaction with industry to improve complaint handling practices. Identification of systemic issues. Each ombuds has extensive marketing and promotion about the existence of their office. Certain ombuds make it compulsory for their members to promote the ombuds scheme, and that is done through their various codes of conduct. Transparency and accountability of ombuds. All four ombuds are accountable to their independent boards. All four ombuds publish clear details about their powers and procedures, example, website reference, promotional leaflets and other publications, telephonic advice to consumers, and annual reports. Each ombud publishes an annual report as per the EFSOS Act requirements, and that deals with the mission and vision of the office, details about board membership and structure of that ombud scheme, various case studies, details of the number and subject matter of the disputes, details on consumer awareness and education initiatives that are undertaken, all relevant statistics, details of the staff employed, as well as financial reports. In terms of submission of complaints, all four ombuds have established a referral protocol. We all have a centralized helpline, 0860-662-837. That is a helpline where a consumer can call and is not sure which ombud should be referred to. That helpline will redirect the consumer to the correct ombudsman that will deal with his matter. With the full support for the proposed ombud regulatory council powers to determine jurisdiction in respect of complaints that don't fall within the clear jurisdiction. We are already establishing a standardized complaint submission process and introducing a single portal and point of entry for all financial complaints. I wish to thank you for this opportunity. I also wish to thank the National Treasury for the various engagements and the various consultations that we've had with them, and we continue to support them as we go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure what the meaning of that statement is. And the first one that says, we fully support the proposals as contained in the bill. And then we go on with the litany of problems you've got. And you say you're constantly engaging with it. You're more of a politician than we are. You know, we will say, we agree, but... And then the next 15 minutes, we will be disagreeing with everything that we agree with. Right? So, the first thing that strikes one, because I need to pitch this discussion, right, is remind ourselves, our collective, it's not written down in rules, but it's our collective, I mean collective, I don't really agree, ethos, if you like, or framework. There's a few statutory bodies, and the government must engage with them, and many of these issues should be sorted out outside of Parliament. Only if the statutory bodies and the government department can't solve their problems, does Parliament have to intervene. We do not have the technical expertise. Little Antonio there, I mean little in a sense, you only have 3 weeks, but he's not going to be able to engage with these guys. And I have no capacity to do. I'm the Member of Parliament for 24. Hey, I'm not on this person. Right? I don't know these things. I'm not a lawyer either. So, it's not possible. We're not the Parliament of Germany or Sweden or Japan. You know? With US Congress, the chairperson has 18 members of staff. The average member, you know, has 6 members of staff who are assist. So, Momo, you and your team, sort these things out. Man. I mean, at this late stage, what do you want us to do? We will meet with you, but I'm suggesting that we present to you some of our issues as Parliament and provide a framework once again for you to sit together and address these issues. Where you cannot find yourselves, neither of you need to work. If the law provides for a role for you and the department deciding to change it, it must come to Parliament to change it. If, on the other hand, these guys are being reasonable and you defending yourself and territory, present politicians work, then hey, you know what? Parliament will decide. But in the meanwhile, there are too many issues here at Momo that should have been resolved. Having said that, let the MP speak and then you come in and respond at an appropriate state. I'm just pitching it, but I realize actually in our program, we hear Kosaju and you were both speaking. And now I hear there's a financial sector coalition. In Asia, you're here. Right, so why don't we, I'm suggesting, deal with the ombuds. The ombuds is so specific, if the members agree, you don't agree, it's fine. Let's deal with the ombuds issues, then we'll take the NGOs. Right? We'll run through the statutory body. Are you going to help us more?
Let me share, I don't think we But let me outline maybe just where we're going, because I think Chair, you know, the OMAS play a critical role, and I think more or less they've done a good job. The problem, of course, that we have is we've got too many OMAS. It's confusing. We've got one for credit, one for banking, one for long-term insurance, one for short-term insurance. Then you've also got your statutory OMAS, okay, which is the pensions fund adjudicator and the price OMAS. And there are some differences between the two and so on. And look, the point is, the OMAS have never had the opportunity to come to Parliament. I can't remember when last they've been to Parliament. To even talk about their work, because if you think about it, the point is, here they have a consumer who's actually not powerful compared to how powerful financial institutions are. So there's something that happens. You always hope that in the first instance, you deal with the company and the company has a proper complaints processing model. Okay, so when we talk market conduct, those are the kinds of things we're going to ensure. If the company doesn't sort it out for whatever reason, the consumer can still then go to the OMBA for an alternative adjudication process. And you can come in as and the idea is that this is a quick, cheap way for the consumer to solve the problem. Remember, people still have the rights to go to court if they don't sort of get resolution through these processes. So I think that these are very important institutions for the consumer. And secondly, I think that the issues of independence and so on come in, because there's degrees of independence. I don't for one believe that this is so independent with the current structure. And there's too many boards. And I've raised issues in the past with one or two of the OMBAs, where I felt when an OMBA gets too troublesome, given that the funding is depending on industry, you know, industry plays a role in big role in the board, they think that their appointment may not be, or they may not be reappointed if they're too troublesome. And we want troublesome on this, okay, when there is a problem. So I think it's about not moving to it immediately, but having a path towards, and this bill doesn't deal with this matter comprehensively, but does want to have more coordination. We have talked through a lot of the issues, and I think the difficulty for a lot of the people who come today is they are responding to the bill as tabled in 2015, which is all they can go by. We've had meetings since, but until they see what we provide in terms of how we amend the laws, how we pick up mistakes, you know, they don't know what's formally been accepted. But I think once they see what we've done, a lot of the technical issues, I think, have been sorted out. Do you want to just come in on and get these things? So I just want to assure the committee, and I think just so that you understand, I guess, where they're coming from, and I guess where we are.
Thanks, Mama. Thank you, Chair. So I think even though most of the concerns that were raised today, and even on the previous version of the tables, are mostly technical corrections as opposed to principle objections to the establishment of a stronger audit task that is going to take standardized requirements across the various audits, which really is the heart of what it is that we're doing in principle. Those technical corrections have been integrated into as we working through what the revised bill should look like. I think there were, for example, there are a couple of issues which were slightly nuanced. So, for example, one of the issues was raised about requiring membership to an ombuds team. Those we've taken on board, but have in that instance provided that where there is one that exists, because there are cases where there's a new product where there isn't actually a suitable team that the product provider could be a member of, and we've drafted accordingly. There was a principal issue that I think was raised through the correspondence, and this we don't have exact agreement on, and it's appropriate to work while of further discussion, which is the extent of standardization across on the team. So one of the issues that was raised was, for example, on I think it was on specifically on complaints process or rules regarding the way in which the ombuds operate. Now, even in terms of the commission, I think that there was some mixed messages on the one hand stating that that goes against the independence of the ombuds, but on the other hand saying that they're actually working towards consolidating and showing up with a consolidated ombuds and paying process on the board here. I think these are, broadly speaking, I think we are working towards a standardization approach. How exactly that is going to affect whether the laws actually provide for the best way from our perspective, I think that would probably have some more engagement. Sorry, just one additional point. I think a lot of the engagement, keeping in mind that this is a big platform, this is the stepping stone. What we're really looking for is an increased standardization, developing a best of breed on the approaches of work. But really a lot of engagement that's happening now is not about the example in particular, but actually maybe through the ombuds that's been going over the next 3 to 5 years, and that's where we need to
change. Sometimes the changes going on would say, if I understand correctly, these ombuds are established in terms of a financial services ombuds schemes council, in terms of the financial services ombuds schemes Act of 2010. And then they are funded by the industry, but they are independent, right? But would they be classified? I think it's important that we know what we're talking about, because it's just a matter of clarity. I have a lot of questions, but I'm not going to go into the answer. Would they be regarded as statutory bodies?
Mm.
No. They're funded by the industry. Although I apologize, I misunderstood. You see, they are established in terms of an act, but they themselves are not statutory bodies. So my argument that you assign each other in the web is just to some extent gets diluted, not altogether. So clarify that. I misunderstood. So comrades, colleagues, can you understand? They are established in terms of an act, but they are not actually statutory per se. Correct, right? And the state has no role in the appointment, the industry has done. The question that arises for members is how independent are they in practice, whatever their constitution and their, you know, terms of reference, I have to say, the ultimate test is, and the consumers are the ones who can tell, amongst other people, the NGOs and so on, how independent are they? Okay, I will draw that answer. Okay, what do you think? Are we agreeing that for now? Mm-hmm. Let's focus on this person here, because it's a completely separate thing from, in front of respect. No, because it overlaps, say, with NGOs and so on. Because I'm not sure. Do members feel we should just look at ombudsperson? There's four of them. Let's focus on these issues, then we look at the other two. But if they think he to be so kindly and Mr. Reed and Mr. Topper.
No, I think I was moving with you in terms of the initial input that you made, that within Treasury and the Ombudsman, there should be some sessions where they are able to find each other, because if you listen to also the input that was made, and there is new information that they might not be having, and it doesn't help us to fit together here, and people are still having outdated information when there's new information. And I thought when we put together the committee, nothing stops you from just sharing information and making sure that other people are empowered. You know, information is power. And we sit here, others are 1 or 2 years later than where you are, and it becomes a problem. But, and I fully agree with your approach here, but the other thing that I'm worried about, I know it's an issue for the next meeting, the ombudsman, Chair. In one of their slides, they are talking about advocacy, outreach, radio interviews, and all other things. I've been in the public sector. There are many challenges for our people. Indebtedness, all these things. People are resigning because of all these things. You have different ombudsmen who were supposed to even at least help people to know how far can they go with loans, how far can they go with all the state, how far financial services people are playing around with us. And that voice, we don't get. I personally don't hear the voice. And what about an ordinary person? Let me have four for now, other than those, because Mona says there are many on that plane. But from the sectors that are very key and relevant to our people, all four of you can be able to assist and clarify our people and assist them to move out of these big challenges that we find themselves in. I don't hear you. And the black majority of our people, whether on short term, from funeral undertaker to everything, these are challenges that our people are going through. And we don't hear your voice in all those things, unfortunately. And on the lighter note, Chef, you know the presentation, all, you know, that presentation. It's like collusion, you know, this time around, we've seen many collusions, you know, banks deciding on this together. Now today is ombudsman, all of us agreeing on, all of us. It's very worrisome. And I'm very skeptical about those kind of things. It's fine to have one voice, but it's also dangerous to have one voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Chef, and thanks for the presentation. I also asked about the approach of how we move forward. I think there should be more sessions between one and Uncle Chen, so that when we come back, we have got fewer things to deal with. Otherwise, we start doing the things which can be dealt with somewhere else. But people are better equipped to do that. Number two, Chair, it's more about the clarification as this committee, what these women and the issues are about, what role do we have and what powers do we have over the office of which men. Yeah, I think we'd like to hear that.
You gave us a new way to make preambles. So can I start also to make a preamble?
Yeah.
Just let me say I'm very pleased to sit in the same room with Ombuds Person. I'm allergic to the word ombudsman. I wish it was an ombudsman. So I prefer to use the word Ombuds Person to make it sound accommodative enough. I hope it was like that. In our description of the institution to make it general. But first, before I ask questions, I want to make this comment. I have to differ with the Ombuds Person when he says that in terms of the work they do, they advertise themselves strongly. And I'll make an anecdote in all of them. When we experienced a problem with a particular insurance company, had we not had a friend who worked for an insurance company who advised us to approach the Ombuds Person, we would have not known that it existed.
Mm.
And fairly enough, at that time I worked for government, so if I was at that level and did not know that an Ombuds Person exists, you can imagine an ordinary layman on the street who would know where to go in an event that the dispute laws became an insurance company and attacking individuals. If I want to make a suggestion that we use different methodology to approach different sections of society to make sure that all of them are aware of the good work that you do. Two, when it comes to the issue of the accountability lines between the Ombuds schemes, I believe there should be a solid, and Mama, I hope you capture this, there should be a solid relationship between government and the Ombuds schemes. And for one good reason, Chair, I want to clarify the question you are asking. An Ombuds Person is a statutory board or should be a statutory board because it's established by an act of parliament. It does not necessarily have to be a statutory one institution for it to be referred to as a statutory board. But we'll ask the lawyers to help us to craft a legal framework that expands on that. And in the effect that Parliament can subpoena it to report to Parliament, also has being of the cognition of the spectrum. So an inward person is established like a spectrum, and therefore it partly is the spectrum. Therefore its accountability is related to how it means to come. So there shouldn't be blame lines when you come to that part. So I believe if you declare federal unit, further engagement between National Treasury and the UMAC future in relation to how they harmonize policy and principles that should govern the deficit. If you allow me to, I'll go straight to the question. You cover?
Can I? Why would you look
at it? No, I was listening to what you said yesterday, and I think you're going to need me to pay for that. That's it. I didn't clarity on two items that have been raised by the ombudsman. He refers to section 174 not being adequate, not giving adequate effect to the principle that is being established in section 101E4. So I need clarity what you mean by this, so that when we zoom into the specific legislation that we will be into this, because once it doesn't give effect, then it means it does not have any legal meaning of standing. Therefore, it's unnecessary. That's the suggestion you make. So, please, clear to this. I will not look at section 194 for now. I'll apply my mind on it and all the subsequent to that relation to that. Let me speak about section 196 as the definition being inappropriate. Can you expand on this? And section 199, you want it to be done in consultation with the relevant schemes. I also want you to further clarify the meaning of this. I will not speak to the issue that speaks on the definition of a user sector ombuds scheme. We look at what you mean when you say it's not defined. Section 26, what do you mean that it needs to be corrected? What? Then there's la la and my mission is successful.
Thank you, sir. Thank you to the ombudsman presentation. I, in a sense, am badly informed or ill-informed about the number of transactions. And so my initial reaction was, gee, only 5,000, because I see three of the ombuds dealt with around about 5,000 issues, and the short-term insurance one, 10,000, including multiple of 5,000 itself. So if you have some idea of the number of transactions that the industries actually deal with, and what proportion you actually deal with of those, it gives us some sort of idea of the state of the industry in terms of its service. I, Mr. Chairman, am also somewhat skeptical about independence, that either you, you impress upon us of the Ombud Board, given that, that they are constituted by the industries. And whilst you say they're funded by the industries, in fact, in my opinion, that's not accurate. No industry is going to afford that cost. That cost actually is passed on to the consumers. So
yeah.
The consumers actually do pay. Although at point of application, there's no additional fee to pay. So it's a bit of a misnomer to say it's free. It's not free. The old expression of there's no free lunch comes to mind. So just some idea, if you do have, about the volumes of transactions to give us some kind of thing. Some of the detail of the presentation, I think, is important, but I'm really not in a position to start commenting or questioning that, and I think the National Treasury will be very open to a discussion about those points if they haven't already dealt with them, as Kathy has indicated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think 26, I was also confused about how this 26 gets in, section 269. Quickly look at the cost curve, and it sort of makes sense to me. Maybe our version is mean, I'd like it, I'm a certain bit. I see what they say about the fines being quite high, but it's also said up to, so these are the powers to give it to that amount. Clarity, There's not going to be a changed number of ombudsmen from what I'm reading. There's going to be a chief ombud who's head of this regulatory council, who's going to recognise the industry scheme ombud. So there's really not going to be a reduction in the number of ombudsmen, is that correct? I'm sorry, okay. Then the powers of these ombuds. If you look at section 194, where it says the regulatory council must recognise it based on a few things. And it looks there, it says, so basically a voluntary association that the different industry members sign up to, and so we agree to be bound by your decision, effectively. And then to the extent that that maybe negates the argument about independence, because it's meant to be, from a reading, a arbitration up of fraternity where industry themselves say, go there first, and if the ombudsman agrees with you, then we'll honour it. And then that leads me to effectively the slide 14, which says that the rights of a companion to seek legal address are not affected by this law. And what you're saying, if I'm correct, that's not spelled out enough. The first law basically says that no provision in the Act affects any rights, and you want that to come in and out. So effectively, it sort of needs to be a stopgap to stop the people having to go to court. But if you don't like to find it, then you can. So that's, I just want to check that my understanding is correct. And that's, so it just seems like this omission is a bit technical omission. I probably put that here for clarity's sake. But I also agree, like I said, most of these omissions are more of a technical nature, so they must a principle thing that makes sense. Sometimes an overkill is better than leaving it potentially in there. So it sounds like some good inputs maybe.
Okay. I don't think I want to ask anything. How can I come back on here and stop? And actually the police to some extent. And you say you'll find each other, so then we'll see what comes out. So we'll see what comes out. But what I think is a useful thing to raise, and maybe my understanding of it himself was actually the lead. I personally don't have a view. It's very early days here. We haven't started. My sense of feeling about this moment is ideally, the question you need to answer, because I think many members are raising it a different way, is should he be in the lead of statutory on the first, given the way the bill is put, right? I mean, then what happened in 2008, given the members saying, that you know, nobody really knows about the on the first. The one that seems to be most well known is the Federal Regulator, what's called the DCI. So, I mean, I don't know whether one can draw a parallel, maybe it's a good thing. You see, you look at the CTAS, right? Well, am I right? The CTAS get their funding from levies and industry, right? But they answer to Parliament. As far as I know, the boards are appointed by the Minister of Higher Education. That's a correct one. Does that understand? Mm-hmm. It's a statutory body and they answer to Parliament. I know they appeal. Yeah, absolutely. It's a similar levy. Doesn't mean industry mustn't pay. They must pay, and it makes a profit, and quite frankly. I mean, this, the bank has done extremely well, it doesn't say anything. I mean, just capital, so the bank has done very well overall. Now, the thing is, maybe decisions to apply to my government, you know, about this thing. But I don't see why it shouldn't, in some form, we're saying these would be foregone, but they have to be, like in the lawyer front, right, and the relationship between these ombuds and that one needs to come, terms of what I'm saying in court is there's a broader issue people are raising about to whom are these ombuds people answering, and shouldn't they be answerable in some form or another to the Parliament? It only means people must. Then the next thing is this bill is presented to us as a way of dealing with a fragmentation of the financial system. Obviously, these ombuds people deal with different aspects. Ombuds short term and long term and so on. But do you actually need so many ombuds people? You know? And shouldn't we rationalize them? I know the people from the credit regulation side came here and made sort of informal presentation in the court last year in November. Where it was said, look, we're worried about how the National Treasury is dealing with a whole movement portfolio of DGI and the credit regulation. And the argument presented then, I think, was very strong, so I hope we hear this. To specifically saying our term presence. It wasn't like a strong argument. Yet there are many strong arguments that could be presented. Some of them were actually brought up, if I remember, by Tangi. Last year. Remember, you gave some strong arguments. Sorry? No. About what you said, maybe. As I remember, my notes here, I'll look it up if I have to. What I'm saying, maybe that's something that we need to apply the mind to. Do we actually need so many regulations? Couldn't we recognize at least some of them? Then the issue of, yeah, these are the issues, but why you left out of jail would make sense. Sort of things that Thomas Sutton said. But you will hear an earlier version of this. They are talking about a whole lot of amendments. So you actually need to remember, can we alert you to this? I would have said anyway, later in the city. We are not processing, the government's rising in 2 weeks because of the elections, but, and then we're going to come back, I think, around the end of the first week of August. And then we've allocated, well, we'll get the program talked about next week too. We're allocating like a whole month where we only look at this month. So, you know, you've got plenty of time between now and say late July to sort out things between the first. Okay, I'm done. But then let them reply first. Because they are appearing before the committee, right? And you understand, right? So do you decide who responds to what?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the fear of falling into that, the all or nothing, and the conclusion. I think each of the various ombuds must take their questions and answer those questions. So I leave it to my colleagues to answer the questions. I'll put in when necessary. Thank you. Just to state that when we started, the intention was exactly what you stated, the technical thing that you make the say at all. When we say support it, in principle, yes, we don't have any principal objection. And we just, in the manner of good lawmaking, it was just fixing up a couple of technical things. So, you know, you might say that if I'm a politician or whatever, I could oust you in a position and could be there. Thank you.
Well, if you agree with the proposal, you could have said we put the principles of it, but we have here. So I understand what you say. Okay, over to whoever wants to go in. Yourself. Doesn't really matter, you all know it's something as well.
Maybe I can just address the first questions that were asked about, and us all speaking with one voice, and the use of the word all repeatedly through the presentation.
Yeah.
I think it's quite important to make a distinction between all speaking with one voice in relation to the way in which we are structured, and all speaking with one voice in respect of the way in which we deal with the individual complaint. Now, in that department, we certainly don't all speak with one voice because we have no idea about the various complaints that the others receive. We deal with our specific industry, and we don't discuss complaints amongst each other, all deal with one voice in that sense. What we are trying to do with encouragement from National Treasury is to rationalise the way in which we present ourselves to the consumer, so that the consumer has a more simplified basis upon which to approach an ombuds scheme, and not four different, quite complicated, different models of a scheme to approach. And I think it was in that statement that we presented to you that we all speak with one voice. It's not a back office single voice. It's more of a front office single voice for the benefit of the consumer. As far as the dealing with the public and speaking and getting the word out there, there are quite a lot of initiatives that are undertaken. I will agree with you that most of those are done at a level that is not accessible to many of the consumers, and many of the publications won't be read by consumers who are most affected by the decisions of financial institutions. And I would certainly agree with you that more can be done, and there are discussions that we have had about how we can potentially do that together, and it is something that I think we are aware of. There are enormous amounts of radio interviews and television broadcast at certain times, but not necessarily sufficient to reach the public. And I think we do get that, and there are certain steps we can take.
I had a good
time
for you.
My name is Clive Allais. I'm a banking ombudsman. I'll address the question of independence insofar as the banking ombudsman is concerned. Now, I'm appointed by an independent board of directors. The board has a majority of non-executive independent board members and a minority of industry board members. So the independent non-executive directors can't be outvoted. That's the first point. The second point is I'm not accountable to the industry. And I don't report to the industry. I'm accountable and report to the board only. Thirdly, I enjoy security of tenure. I can't retire the industry or consumer bodies if I make a ruling that they are not happy with. Fourthly, one of the functions of my board is to guarantee my independence and to deal with any attempts at interference. And then lastly, fifthly, one of the other functions of my board is to ensure that my office is adequately resourced so that I have enough manpower and enough equipment. And then the last point I'd like to make is in the nature of an analogy. Now I hear lots of people, if not everybody, saying, but how can you claim to be independent when the industry pays you? But is that the correct argument, the correct question? Surely my independence should be judged by the caliber of my work, and not by who pays me. Not even though I've already mentioned all the safeguards. And then very lastly, if you look at judges, judges are paid by the state. But I don't think anybody in this room will claim that judges are not independent. And we have many instances of judges making rulings against the state. So clearly, the source of one's funding is not the be-all and the end-all of independence. One should judge somebody's independence by the nature and the caliber of the work the person does. Thank you, Chair.
It says here that, and you said it too, all of independent boards comprised of non-executive independent representatives have a majority. Who appoints these non-executive independent representatives? Firstly. Secondly, Advocate Pelé, with due respect to you, it's not personal, it's not about you and your performance, it's about the life of politicians. Given what has happened in the industry, one of only to pick the channels of the TV that you have before you or watch a movie in the most established democracies in the world and discover that in similar situations where industry is paying for somebody and in terms of the law and in terms of the norms and rules, there is the independence you speak of. There is a reasonable suspicion at times that decisions are unconsciously, not consciously. And so I can agree with most of the things you say. But it still doesn't detract from the validity of what members are asking, right? I mean, really, as a Catholic, you can say all of those things, but it could still mean, not you personally, people in your position, not being fully independent. The issue really is, can I go on to that, if I may, that actually, given what has happened in the banking industry since 2008, you as the industry, I'm not saying you personally have to get the name. I'm talking about you have brought this upon yourself. The filing association told them, hey guys, you're complaining here. What was it is not the greed of the bankers in the United States that has brought us to where we are on our knees, with 0.5% growth rates, 0.9%? What about you personally? Furthermore, I don't think it's correct to suggest that it's the quality of your decision making. We're not able to judge. In other words, as MPs, we don't look at what you're doing. Straight for us to ask. It's a reasonable thing to say. But shouldn't you be a statutory body
And we're not saying you shouldn't be funded by the industry. In fact, the analogy I drew, for what it's worth, trying to take into advocates here, is that you can still continue to be funded by the industry. But what's the problem, given the huge destructive effects of the post-2008 financial and economic crisis, in the state having come, say, in the appointment of some of these ombuds people, and you answer into Parliament, notwithstanding the fact that you may get paid. And that's what the leaders, ultimately who pays at the end. It's a consumer. That's the way the free market operates. Now, this is not a critique of the free market, it's just the least who really supports the free market, maybe more of a social democrat than, let's say, Helen Zille is, but they support the free market, right? But Helen Zille, she's on Leon. All right, modestly these days, I really think people should be Tony Leon. I don't agree with him, but it gives me a lot of insight. Keep all that aside, that's really not being fair. Right? So firstly, who exactly appoints the non-executive independent of this?
The existing board members appoint new members to the board.
Who appointed the original board members?
I'm not able to say. When I arrived and I took up a position, there were a number of directors already.
But presumably appointed by somebody or the other. Who would it be?
Well, you know, what we try and do is to have a mix of various board members. We actually have a mix of board members representing certain constituencies. So we ensure that we have, for example, a board member who's from a consumer body.
Oh, right.
And
so you represent people not just in the industry.
Yeah.
Who are advisors? You don't know.
We make it known that there's a vacancy.
Oh,
the
vacancy.
And then they advance names. And so, for example, we would get three names from the South African National Consumer Union.
Yeah.
Of eligible people, and we would appoint one of those. Okay, may I just say, though, to clear any misunderstanding, I'm not taking it personally. I'm talking on behalf of the banking industry. When I say me or I mean the banking ombudsman.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, okay, let's just come here. I think she wants to pick up the same issue, and I think she wants something for you. Are you...
Check.
Is this the same issue?
Check.
So we haven't had one other ombudsman response. Is it around the issue of clarity about how the boards are appointed?
So I don't want to speak about how the boards are appointed. I want to speak about the functions of the ombudsman.
Alright, let's allow the ombudsman to finish.
But it was the follow-up on the basis of...
Oh, then fine, then ask it,
when I listen to Mr. Pillay, it becomes very difficult not to understand what PG was trying to say. It makes me to look very close to the public perceptions about the role of combat schemes. I'm not presenting a fact. I'm not presenting a case of facts that can be tested. But I'm presenting a public conception of the role of the combat schemes. And allow me to borrow from an anecdote, a personal anecdote. If you present a case to an ombuds person, it takes a year, a turnover of a year for the ombuds person to deal with it. Thoroughly consultative response has been fixed from insurance companies where there's overwhelming evidence that the insurance companies are at fault. It suggests that there's an element of bias to what the benefit of the insurance company. I do not want us to sit here and try to test whether ever since the ombuds schemes has been established, cases that has been dealt with were at the best interest of the consumer or not, because I don't think that's what we're here for. But what we're here for is to try to make sure that there's an element of independence and we can assure that to the public as public representatives. Without counting the fact that we should not present it as if the ombuds schemes had not dealt with its independence in the proper manner. So I have not established a view yet, I think, to get the point where I'm driving. So the extent that we see loopholes in terms of how
the app itself, governments, it's them that the SU can to come from. So what we need to be dealing with is a policy perspective of harmonization between the relationship of the UMBA change and the role that government plays in its intervention. I think that's the gist of the matter. So I thought we're moving in that direction, Chair, if you get the point. Thank you.
Well, I think it's a philosophical question whether one believes in statutory or non-statutory ombudsman.
And I
think all over the world that question is being asked. And in this country we have two, we've got statutory and non-statutory schemes. And I think there are benefits and disadvantages to both. And I think before one makes the decision that you want to go to the statutory route, you should have a very close look at what are the advantages and disadvantages of the two kinds of models.
That's what we need to do.
And as to the question of our impartiality, I think one of the things, one of the principles of the ombudsman scheme is that you have to be impartial. And you have to give both parties the opportunity to take their case before you. So yes, sometimes it does take a long time because things pass from one party to the other. But I think when one compares our schemes with schemes all over the world, and we do that constantly in order to get best practice, I think our turnaround time stands up to scrutiny. I don't know a particular case that was mentioned, but certainly in our scheme, one of the ways that we ensure that there is satisfaction for the complainant or the insurer is that we always make a provisional determination first. The parties have 30 days within which to come back to us. If they're still not satisfied even with the final determination, they have the right of appeal. And the complainant always has the right to go to court. In addition to that, to ensure that we get satisfaction, we do surveys amongst the complainants every 2 years, and we have a high satisfaction rating on that. Every 3 years, we get an independent person to do an audit of our scheme. So I think there's a lot done by the ombudsman scheme to ensure that we are actually complying with our mission and our statement. And I hear what was said about our role, and I think we've just got to be very clear that we are there to resolve disputes. We raise awareness about the officers, but we don't actually have an education role at the moment in terms of educating consumers about financial issues. We do that on the side, we tell them what the problems are, etc. But consumer education is not our main focus. Our main focus is resolving complaints. And if we have to take on education role, then I think we would need a whole new budget to do that. And we would also have to be very careful that we don't tread on other bodies that do consumer education, through the FSB, etc. What has happened? And there needs to be more awareness of our scheme. We all agree on that. Through legislation now, whenever a complaint, whenever a claim by an insurer is turned down, they have to advise a particular person about our office. So at that point, they are advised about our office. Every policy that is issued has our details in it as well. Not everyone reads the policy. So it's very important that members should know that at the time when a claim is turned down, the claimant is actually told about our office.
Fine.
Hey, Chair, I think I was going to say, and some of the points that we made, that the issue of the ombud is a complex one. And firstly, I think just to remind members, I think it's quite important to go to the whole architecture of the system that we deal with. We want to deal with market conduct. And when we released the bill and did the presentation, Chair, before, just on the market conduct, what do we call it, the policy book, the policy paper that we had, the framework. Because I think it's important in the chain to understand who does what and why do they do it. So to give an example, we want in the first instance, every company that operates in the financial sector must operate according to certain standards. They must treat their customers fairly. Then you have a situation, every company is going to have complaints. What is their complaint mechanism like? Now, that's why you want the regulators to look at the quality of the complaints mechanism. this also an important feedback for companies because it tells them where they have to fix things up. And today they don't need social media pictures up for them. And if you look at amongst the ombuds here, there's very different things they do. Some, they deal with long-term policies. So I would guess there's much fewer policies and single points for life policy happens when someone dies or whatever the policy comes to an end. The credit ombuds, on the other hand, will deal with lots and lots of transactions. The banking ombuds will be everything but not credit. So, maybe fewer than, I don't know what the numbers are. If we deal with short-term insurance, lots of people sort of want to say, well, when an accident happened, actually, it's not our fault, and therefore the company should pay, no matter what, even if they've been reckless. So you get different types of complaints. The important thing is, first you want the company to be able to have an independent process within itself, and we use independence in different ways, but a relatively independent process to deal with complaints. Then, if that's not resolved, the customer goes to the ombud. The ombud has to see, has the company dealt with it adequately. The ombud has to then try and, we've had a past where an ombud has been seen as a consumer activist. That's a disaster. Because the problem is, at the end of the day, the ombud is not seen to be fair between the two. And fair is a word where we've also said we don't expect consumers to read these documents, that there needs to be, and for example, the Free Market Foundation has opposed that we transfer contracts must meet with certain customer-friendly approaches. So what happens with the ombud is that when the complaints come, and obviously they have a case, one can look at how quickly they're looking. If the industry is not happy with it, the problem then is that they will take the matter back to court because they don't want precedent to be set. Now that's what you want to avoid. So the pros of the industry ombud is that the industry accepts generally what the ombuds rule on. When you have the statutory ombud, the industry actually contests and then go to court. So the process of the customer takes much longer. So I'm just saying there's pros and cons. And what I would ask for, so if you go back to the draft framework document, there was a chapter on the ombuds office. And I think when we're looking at the role of the ombuds in the context of legislation, the scope is narrow. But perhaps what would be good is just to have an open discussion on ombuds, what they do, what the different models are, how best should they be funded. Because it's also not a case of, again, whatever you mean by independence, it's also that you seem to be independent. Because whoever complains, when the result goes against you, then you're going to say they're not independent, just because you haven't won your case. How do you guard against those things? I'm just saying, at the best of times, these issues are complex, and there are certain products like, for example, let's look at funeral policies. Now, not all of them are necessarily regulated. Yes, the FSB has been slowly trying to regulate those, but remember, it's not just the payout of funeral policies, but often these are done with the local funeral parlor, and that's been, a lot of the issues are customers getting value for money and so on. So I think all the questions that have been raised by members on rationalization, whether they should be statutory or not, we've not tried to deal with it in this book because we try to be too much in this book. We sort of just lay a basis for better coordination and getting standards and so on in this book. We do think that once we've done print piece, let's have the discussion. Because I do think that currently the process does work reasonably well. Yes, there are parts that could be improved. But down the line, we do need to make the bigger decisions. Do you want one ombud? Must it be statutory? How are they funded even if they're not statutory? And so on. So I think we would like to come back to it, but perhaps the bird is not the right place to deal with all these issues, because I think then it's complex enough and it's going to be quite hard. And I would want to put it into the chief customer's fairly sort of basket. Do you want to say it?
Very briefly.
We just
need
to remind that we have an evolving conduct framework as well, and
what Bill is there pushing as a second stroke towards harmonization. In other words, the best thing, as I said, is there's agree on the across the board, even though there's more than one, as opposed to consolidation. And what that means, once we've agreed with the right level of research and interrogation on how consolidation happens, we'll already have standardized across, and it will make that consolidation much easier. Keeping in mind, as I said, we're looking towards having a single conduct act as well, and what we're looking at is to see what that looks like, because that will also then inform what the ombuds should do to respond to politicians.
Yeah, all right. Do you really want our time with these?
Tuna, I was wondering whether my question about the volume of transactions.
I have some volumes in regard to, this is specifically credit bureau related matters. That is, there's wrong information placed on the bureau. Various bureaus last year received 105,129 kind of inquiries of disputes. Now, what process that we follow, you can't come to us before going to the bureau or to a credit provider. And in many instances, those get resolved at that stage. Of that 105,000, we received about 24,000 calls in respect of that. Of the 24,000 calls, we opened 5,000 cases, or 5,000 were genuine cases. So I have this statistic only in relation to the credit bureau. It's difficult to get stats in regard to which each credit provider, how many disputes they, some of them don't keep a record and some of them find confidential information. But from the credit bureau point of view, this is a comprehensive one because all bureaus report to us under the Credit Bureau Association. So that's it for context.
Thank you very much.
Anyone?
Can I
also
return for making?
One of the elements that others are that differ from my court of law is that when the court of law will look at the evidence before it and make a determination, we go further. We look at the law, we look at other things, but we also look at equity in terms of how badly were you harmed, the distress, etc. So we have an equity clause in all our recommendations that goes beyond a court of law. What we're stating is that in the absence of law, there are specific provisions, and the section I quoted in says that where appropriate to apply principles of equity in resolving a complaint. We think that is beneficial for the consumer, and what we're asking for is that sections that deal with it, the 174, 199, which like the equity principles, incorporate. Thank you.
Are these specific issues under U.S. analysis, I think, results within the discussion, and then they come back to the next sitting on this matter. And we process the bill level and tell us how far it's gone. I just want to say, listening to Wong Mama say, I get a good sense now that I can see why the ombudsperson can't be a consumer activist, because they've been treated like judges. They've been impartial to the industry when they act against it, will accept it. Hey. Whereas if you become a consumer activist, then you'll be seen as biased towards the consumer, and hey, you need anything to go to support the consumer. Why should I accept your credibility? And I can see your other point, I think colleagues will apply their mind. What do you need to agree with me? I think I like Momo's summary, and Jimmy Andy Ryan talked about four. The other point he makes, remember that if it's a security report, the tendency of the other agency to go to court all the time. But if it's an ombudsperson within the agency, they tend to, more or less, in more cases, accept the outcome. Then the other point I think he made, which I found quite useful, was, look, I really found what you said correct. I look really useful in getting, for me, a perspective. But what it does raise, and I say this, you know, quite frankly, I'm a member of Parliament in 1994. I think about 15, 16 cases. Usually it's short-term insurance. The perception of the constituents that come to our office today from BT Management is the honest person is either ineffective and or biased. And when I pursue it on behalf of a constituent MP, on behalf of constituents as a constituent MP, I must say, I don't have very good experience. Even writing in Parliament, you get ahead. I mean, I've been in the case for about 5 or 6 years, but between 1994 and about 2006, I've had about odd one or two cases a year. In most instances, Ombuds was not very responsible, even though you're a public representative, you know, and you're taking that on your own behalf. Because once you
is involved in my constituency, and I said, this is my constituency, you know, in Sindhusi. I'm the local MP at the time. What am I supposed to do? Tell her to go to some other MP. So I did indicate just outside her. She's my sister, look at the merits of the case. And I must tell you, that's the one time I did this. And I wondered, really, simply because Tanya is a relative of mine. So she didn't get all that she wanted. They made quite a huge confession. Quite frankly, that in itself is worrying. I openly said, I said, this is my sister, but she lives in my constituency, and I'm raising it, but I'm happy to, because this is my sister, look at it on the merits. If you have no case, dump it. But guess what? This is one way I make some headway. That in itself is a V. Now, I'm not attacking you, advocate, what do you mean? Not attacking you personally. I'm just telling the perceptions and members, you can get technical and legal about it, right? As you want to do as a lawyer. But what the members are saying here is something, you know, there is a perception that is there. We are going to the chef, they can't pay that. But this is the point of financial services board. They hear, you need to think about it. So the members are lost. Not many people know about it. There are many people who are most in need of that. So this is a critique, really, thinking of the financial services board, kind of itself. I'm beginning to get a sense of how wasting time. But you know, we don't need 8 million for that. Right? So, do you want to speak? Fine, but you must speak.
I'll be very brief. I just want to respond to what things that the officers, and as Nikki said earlier, I'm very new in the office, but there has been the last 3 or 4 years an incredible drive to deal with turnaround times. Now, at the time you're talking about back in the early 2000s, matters were taking months, sometimes years to resolve. All of the officers can brag of an average turnaround time of somewhere between, well, most of the officers, 70 and 80 days. Which, and statistics are run every single month to make sure that that kind of backlog problem that did persist earlier no longer exists. There are the odd cases that do take a long time, but the majority of cases are resolved in under 3 months.
Fine, let's leave it at that. Over to Kosaki.
Look, you're always a state. Surely you have work to do in some
okay. You can't say if you want. Okay, thank you. Who's next, Kosaki?
So, Matthew, on the process of father, you know.
Hi, Matthew. I can predict what you're going to say, so I'll probably know the
answer. Good morning, members. Good morning, Chair, colleagues, comrades. Of course. Future candidates are male and female. There's always growth.
You're very right.
So we've got new t-shirts. And all made locally as per factors are requirements. Well, thanks very much, Comrade Chair, and thanks for giving Kosato a chance to share his thoughts on this very important and progressive bill. Yes, my name is Matthew, I'm from Kosato's parliamentary office. And thanks for giving us a face. And of course, anytime members want to engage Kosato, we're always happy to try to assist. I think, Chair, also what I can say, it might shock Treasury that we support a bill from Treasury.
Who will have a heart attack?
Where's Momo?
You're worried now. He's actually
becoming so sick. Another collision.
Well, we saw the ACPP said it was strengthened strategic alliances. We took the line from the Vanguard Party. But no, Chair, I think we view this as a progressive bill, which quickly wants to help consumers, wants to try to strengthen oversight and so on. So I think, Chair, our interests overlap with government in this regard, and we strongly support it. We don't have areas of objection within the bill, but if there are areas we think we can suggest for further strengthening the bill, or even other bills related to this one. I think, Chair, we support it because we view that it's learning the lessons of the 2008 global economic crisis, which saw us in South Africa lose a million jobs very quickly. I think so. We also see that we're learning the lessons from the African bank episode of a few years ago. I think so. We also want to say that, you know, also there are critics of Kosato who think Kosato is just complete public service union federation. One of our larger affiliates is a trade union called Sasco. It has about 70,000 members, the majority of banking workers. And with you, they work quite closely with governments to save jobs in African banks debacle. And we appreciate government's efforts to make sure that no jobs are lost during that episode. And we want to see the kind of message sent from governments. Chair will also give us bill quite useful in sort of learning those lessons, developing early warning mechanisms around financial stability and so on. And I think also support its attempts to extend the oversight role of the Reserve Bank. Chair, of course, the areas that we cannot but agree with, promoting greater transparency and accountability and oversight, provide greater coordination in the sector with government and intervention mechanisms. I think, Chair, we're also hopeful that its objectives of promoting greater consumer protection, rights and industry standards will be met. And of course, Chair, also support and hope that the kind of opaque, to use government words, banking charges and abuses will be reduced in the sector. And of course, Chair, we must support government efforts to strengthen credit vision efforts. Maybe comments can also bear with us. Some of the issues we've flagged to be strengthened are not necessarily strictly fought in this bill, but we feel they are important sectoral issues. Some might fall in this bill, some might fall in the future documents from government, some might fall under related legislation such as the Credit Act. But we thought we should just flag anyway. Of course, Chair, we're not on the tools of the banking sector. We just want to reflect ordinary workers' concerns. They might seem very pedestrian, but for workers, they're quite fundamental. I think we must take concern if objectives around financial stability having this kind of excessive concentration of capital within a few banks. I think for us, that is a bit of a worrying challenge. But we do admit that our banking sector is largely as stable as and so on. I think, Chair, we must also raise concern without sounding like a broken record player about the lack of significant transformation in 32 years of democracy in the banking sector, from ownership towards where profits and funds are invested, towards job creation, etc. Chair, I think the bill gave out a mandate for the Reserve Bank for how to intervene. We think that needs to be expanded progressively to look at issues of job saving, job protection and job creation. So in the line that Treasury intervenes, the Reserve Bank rather, and the African banks project jobs, we think that kind of should be solidified and issue a key measure of government. Chair, we know there's not within the bill's parameters, but of course if the risk if we didn't get started that we think the Reserve Bank should be nationalized. It should belong to the public, it should be owned by the states or governments, and it shouldn't be having shareholders that it's a private bank. But you know that's not within this bill, but just making the point, Chair. Chair, a major concern for our members is about the excessive and exorbitant bank charges and of course the high interest rate they're charged. We're hoping that this book will be strengthened and comes the regulatory authority to be further powers to try to deal with that massive challenge. Also from the banking sector, water takers bill as a signal to reduce lending to low-income consumers, to small businesses, SMEs. As you said, in this economic growth rate of 0.5 to 0.9%, what we really need are further economic stimulus, further support to low-income earners and small, medium, micro enterprises. So we have a bit of a contradiction that, according to banking sector's theoretical economic perspectives, the higher the risk you are, the higher the charge you for lending. Which means that ordinary workers who is desperate for a loan to buy a house, buy a car, take care of a family in an emergency, it pays a higher interest rate than somebody who's rich. We're really in issue of the opposite. We know it might make checkbooks a sense, but our situation is that, in fact, we should be having low interest rates for low-income earners and small businesses. We should be punishing them, and in fact, we should be in a situation where currently the poor in effect subsidize the rich, which is a gross immoral contradiction. Chair, we've had a good comrade and friend, Comrade Momo, is here. We know he's spent a lot of energy over the years trying to encourage workers to save, which is correct. We would have thought that, you know, following Mr. Chadwell's example, we would see an opportunity. If you ask workers to save, the interest rate they give the banks for saving is usually below inflation. So which workers would just give as much as the bank when the interest rate for saving is so minuscule? We would have wanted to see government opportunists and say, let's find ways to incentivize workers to save and to squeeze the bank as opposed to squeezing workers. So I had to get more.
The thing is, you say these things, I must have the answer that Momo's still a comment.
No, we want to bring out a comment, Chair.
Let
me get
back.
No, we want to bring it back. We want to capture Momo. We don't want Momo to capture what people have in Dubai. In terms of college education and empowerment, we support the growth targets to increase it and so forth. But I think also it can just be about setting sexual standards. There's an inherent contradiction to expect the banks or the financial bodies, the lending companies, to give a full and unbiased education approach to ordinary consumers. There should be an additional kind of neutral, unbiased platform to educate financial consumers. Otherwise, if you just give it to the semi centers, referring consumers on a daily basis, from the call centers, they're going to short-change consumers. They're not going to give us fortunes, they're not going to really empower them. Chair, we do appreciate the many anti-ombuds persons which exist, but it's still feel quite far removed from the average consumer, and more should be done to try to bring it down to the ordinary level. Chair, what are the huge problems of ordinary consumers and workers is that they fall behind on the home loans or the car loans. And then after a few months, the banks, because of the profitability, they auction off the homes and the cars. Often you hear reports of banking officials doing this in a corrupt way, sell up the house or the cars to their friends and then flip for a quick profit. We think we really should be looking at ways to strengthen, to minimize, to get more difficult to do. There's not a small thing. The person who loses a house to the bank won't get another home loan again. That means the family is forever condemned to homelessness, to excessive rents, and when they retire, they'll not have a home of their own. So, shall we think
before I forget, this is a court decision on this now, this week, about banks just selling off homes without negotiating. Can I tell you, and maybe to some extent, Frank, because here's the meaning of this. I think there should be a paper done for the question. If possible, a draft paper that you submit for 10 minutes in the last week of our sitting. Because it may be necessary more to look into the legislation that comes through. But this thing, it's a horrendous case, right? And you know, Ruth Pingu raised that when she was chairing local government some years ago, remember? This lady in Grey Town in Kinga area, her house was sold for like 300 grand or something, right? 103,000 rand, and it's worth about. So this thing, I just want to let the minister, how do we need to actually apply this money to it? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, that's the kind of thing we think there should be a vote from this bill or another bill, but it's a matter of the high vote resolution. So also in a similar spirit, we won't really participate in this bill, but we were recalled to last year, Judge Desai, in the Washington State High Court, had a very focused judgment about gambling order abuses. We know that the Department of Justice is bringing two progressive bills to Parliament this year, the Magistrate Bill and the Debt Collector Bills, trying to deal with some of those abusive garnishing orders, when literally workers are being robbed blind, often without even the knowledge. As Chair, this is also an opportunity to look at how can this bill also be further strengthened to prevent those kind of abuses. Chair, we were glad you mentioned the issue of the National Credit Regulator. We support this bill, but we also support the progressive role of the National Credit Regulator, the National Credit Act. Our only call here is that if there's some issues that concern from the NCR funds, that Treasury, the Foreign Industry, the NCR, sit together and engage and make sure everybody's on board. So, we wouldn't want to have any unintended consequences down the road on the money. Chair, remember the loan sharks largely are dealt with the National Credit Act, but I'm not sure that's sufficient or perhaps there's a space here also to further pressure banks or the sector on that regard. And we saw how the loan sharks were part of the spot which did Marikana a few years ago. I think lastly, Chair, to the way to strengthen the bill, we thought also that in other government bills and oversight bodies, that perhaps there could be a role for organized labor, civil society to participate in the relevant oversight committees or working groups or authorities, and being part of their expertise to set as a further second on this progressive bill. So I hope we will shortly speak. This is a bill that we welcome, we support it. We think we could make it even stronger and we could make it a more progressive bill. But I think it's a useful tool to power government to act on behalf of consumers and ordinary workers. So I think, Chair, would encourage members to consider our suggestions. Then lastly, we would encourage government parliaments to pass this with a matter of urgency based on help ordinary consumers. And thanks very much for coming, Chair.
In all the years I've been here, this is the first time Kandi Constructor has been so conciliated. Never before. Even on the most common sense, straightforward, long-class issue bill, right? Because that's what we're coming up with.
So if one's talking about capture, I think it's national tragedy capture of the fascist policy of Israel. I hope you don't find me in Momo. Okay. But other than through the financial sector. Okay. He can do something. This is what Lindy is pleading. He's coming from KZN in 1992.
Right. Go ahead,
my
friend.
Good morning, sir. Good morning. Good morning, sir. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, members. My name is Tidello Hadere. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to make this presentation tonight. But it will be very, very short, sir. That's also without much of legalese or technical matters. But also we thought it is important for us to introduce quickly who the Financial Sector Campaign Coalition is, an organization that was formed in 2002. At that time, made up of around 80 progressive civil society formations. It has represented tens of thousands of members in the municipal, religious, labor, community, and corporate sectors. Its aim is to campaign around issues and the need for the transformation of the financial sector, as well as pursue changes necessary for the development of an internal alternative people-focused economy for Africa. Turning to the presentation itself, the first key comment takes note, comments the process that we have brought us to this point and takes note of the fact that the bill is presented to Parliament for the third time now after its changes to the first and second bills were expected following due consideration of relevant public comment. We trust that this process will continue to indeed ensure meaningful participation of the general public in the processes of formulation of legislation as part of the dictates of the constitution of our country. We note further, Chair, with due appreciation to the extent to which the bill now emphatically provides for the independence and added potential effectiveness of the credit regulator in particular, within the MDB's 26 months. This factor, among others, has been and continues to be a key bone of contention for the FSC all along, given the relentless campaigns that have been waged by the FSC to date, which have directly contributed to the creation of the credit regulation regime. Chair, paradoxically, it is further noted with many reservations that while the bill correctly seeks to empower the minister with wide and far-reaching powers for further regulation of the financial sector, most of this work is to be done through the same Reserve Bank, which continues to be an entity that is settled with so much of paying investors, some of whom, in our current fashionable language, includes foreigners and one powerful European family which owns shares in over 100 other central banks around the world and is a major player in the globe with regard to our control. In our opinion, interestingly, this bill appears to center around tampering with matters related to the pending review of the Banks Act and the Payment Systems Act. The Payment Systems Act, in our view, is a key tool used for the maintenance of the status quo and the whole pace of transformation of the sector. We take it here, do all kinds of things, but for as long as we are not very near to the control of the Payment Systems Act, the financial sector, in our view, will likely remain as it is. So we understand that the purpose of the bill is to regulate, supervise, and stabilize financial sector institutions, maybe so that they may continue to make even bigger profits. Someone else may argue. However, we think that it still continues to fall short with respect to elevating the most intrinsic interests of especially the poor bill does not mention how the poor would afford to ensure a court order may enforce the recovery of their losses from what any rogue institution may visit upon them. That's very well to say, yes, you know, at a certain point, court can be approached, but we know that today, particularly in this country, you have to be very wealthy actually to afford you know, basic justice. In fact, the bill clearly enhances measures for what would essentially be bailouts for ailing or even errant financial institutions. Chair, in addition, the bill calls for the process of setting high international standards, which we believe must be balanced with the real conditions prevailing in a country now and perhaps into the near future. Conditions such as the low literacy rate as well as the wide absence of financial literacy. Since such stringent bar tends to feed the unintended proliferation of, for instance, questionable funeral operators who exist in large numbers, precisely because they serve a dire need. To mention, for example, we didn't have a stringent measure without whether some of these questionable practices would actually even appear. In our future, some non-negotiables are checked with that. The Ombudsman's Council has an ambitious envisaged in the bill. Financial sector tribunals have to be supported by measures that will provide for one, they must be affordable. No point in having them if it's going to again cause an arm and a leg to actually access them. And of course, widest possible accessibility for an either poor, and the poorest, of course, to ensure economic justice, which is currently denied. We are, Chair, going to carve out a really transformed future in the financial sector. We are encouraged by reference to, we are assumed to be a leniency agreement approach with cooperative persons, which we regard as highly welcome. Because it is important that authorities have to investigate all those entities whose operations may be found to be outside specific financial sector laws with a view to regularize them if possible. We are encouraged by this. Yeah. And finally, oh, maybe before we come, yes, this long overdue action against the big conglomerates, the intention to regulate all, and re-emphasize all conglomerates, is highly welcomed with the hope that it will, among others, lead to undoing the widespread tendencies to evade taxes and or to channel profits into tax havens. In conclusion, Jeff, overall the bill appears to have numerous merits. We eagerly await its regulation, which we hope will provide with real teeth to begin to effect true transformation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. All the members. Handy. Mr.
Chair, I have one question. It relates to the concept of stock control.
You're not speaking to the mic.
Chair, can you hear me now?
Yeah. Well, you can speak into the mic with you.
No, I can speak into the mic with you.
I'm saying
I want clarification to the concept of self-control. I've read a lot of literature that relates to that. So I'm interested to understand perceptive understanding of that to see how it relates to the corporate world. It was a very interesting subject that has never been tabled for discussion anywhere. Anybody who raises issues of mind control
I think that people are paranoid. So I want to know whether it's related to the history I've read or in something.
Okay, is that it,
Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. I'm on the same page as Sandy, as happens. I'm curious, can you give us the name of this one powerful European family that owns shares in 100 other central banks, and which European country their citizens are? That's quite a thing, really, and I'm curious. The other thing is, what do you mean by somewhat opaque private investors? Yeah, what do you mean? Do you mean you don't know who they are?
Any other questions, people? Okay. Can I just ask, I think for the sake of clarity, I'm doing the job of the chairperson. I know what it says. Obviously, I'm familiar with the issues of religion. but I sort of ask her, I'd like to expand on this. I know what you said, but what can you say? You said the purpose of the bill is you see grand banks to regulate, supervise, and stabilize them. But that's so that they may mainly continue to make even bigger profits. Can you explain what you mean by that? Namely, it continues to fall short with respect to elevating most of the intrinsic interests of especially the poor. Again, I understand you, but I think the committee may, in fairness, come to the clarity. Now, you're referring to pay, it's essentially this bill, an answer measures for what we essentially be bailouts for any or even errant financial institutions, we can explain that. I think all the issues have already been covered by the committee, like our concern about balancing out the high, as you put it, international safety standards with the conditions of financial literacy. I mean, we can see in earlier sessions, the committee is very preoccupied with financial literacy, but also financial sector, this is more existing. And the critical funeral parlour operation, just explain how the bill, we were hoping it was contained and controlled, the curtain, just saying it's going to open up the doors for them to expand. That's the one I don't understand the bill. The rest of it, I think I'm fine with, especially will respond. Then to Kosatu, you call for greater participation of organized labor and civil society, like in the bill. Now, there are sections where they have to consult. Do you want us to include, really including, organized labor? Or even consult the public, formally, it's anybody and everybody, but is there a specific case you want to make, and is there a provision in the bill that you want to amend it? If not now, you can write to us and say, on this clause, we think, you know, we should... have some say of organized labor. As you rightly say, the issues you raise are in some form or another, to some measure or the other, agreed to by some or other members in this committee, the broader issues raised. We have noted in the committee our concern that it seems that four banks have over 80% of the market in this country. Every day we read about the high level of monopolization of the financial sector in this country, as compared to other countries. Whether it's accurate or not, we need some work done around that. But what we're saying is that the committee has in various ways raised that. So, you know, to some other extent, we agree with you. On that of transformation, again, we're aware. Momo was a great sort of respect, but I mean, it's the industry that we should address this. You get four people here, right? Two women, two men, ombudsperson. Not a single person is African 23 years down the road. What's the issue that needs to arise? See, we have people of quality and caliber. Who can, not going to question the contribution of the four people who are here before us. So, you know, even that little thing will more communicate that we need some sort of, and I'm speaking for myself when I say, I don't have crude racial transformations here. The African people should just be put there for the sake. That's my view, my comrades are disagree. I'm not speaking for that narrow view. But I think really, for the broader national democratic transformation, all of us, in a sense, is bound by that. Government parties, manifestos, people, that. It doesn't look for 23 years down the road. The rest of it is more views, very high members of the views are more about the transformation of the financial sector.
But I'm encouraged by your, I must say, by your statement. I think this book, overall, is reasonably pro-consumer. I think it's a big chapter. I'm not implying anything about any personally about him here. I mean the balance of power between the industry and the inventor. And, you know, the credibility, not about the individuals there. They may be card-carrying members of the Communist Party, who knows? I don't really know who they are. What I'm saying is, not about individuals. The thing is, after 2008, who can actually say that the financial sector is credible to the whole disadvantage? Okay? And it's a point being made from my brother here, which is, hey, the people, it's interesting, Momo, it's right, but I know how the bank will argue, right? The people that most need the money pay the highest interest, right? The banks will say, well, they most likely to, what's the word here? Not pay the default, that's the one I'm looking for, default. Right, therefore we have to be, you know, yet on the other hand, it's true what a business says, and why would a business say anything inaccurate? And the banks have done very well financially in the last financial year. They're like, well, they've done very well, despite the economic depression.
Not as well as they used to do before, but it's still
well. Oh, they haven't done as well as they used to do before. Alright, but I don't just see all the stuff. I'm told you here, not just correct. Chairperson, you're wrong. This is correct. I don't mind. Some fucking nonsense, Antonio. Your job as a researcher, in this committee at least, I don't know what happens in other committees. Some people can oppose it, but the other two will vote on it. The researcher has the right to speak wherever she or he wants to. So does the advocate Jenkins, and so does Quiet, and so does Adam. These are all people with head of their own, independent mind. They speak a lot of sense, probably more sense than the average MP. I'm not implying anything thinking about you or me. I'm saying that sometimes you make a lot more sense. And you save us a lot of time, Antonio, in a month or so, you can't be sitting quiet. You can say, no, the chairperson are wrong. They're not making very good profits. They're making relatively good profits, but not as much profits as they used to last year. Hey, that's your job, really. Pick up a chairperson in the first instance. Don't take on Tandy, she'll knock you down. Right? Take on Pinky, don't take on Tandy, she'll really knock you down. Now then, have you said the most profound thing this whole morning? If you want to say something.
Great, thank you, Chief. Just two things. I think it covers generally the presentations which have been made. You know, whenever a bank holds, you find that every bank around to ensure the bank was properly regulated. But that means if you are going to create trends to improve the better, and the financial sector is properly regulated and so on. So I that is more to more and the view that in the view that we are giving, you think that we have got proper checks and balances. I'm not very sure. That's one. If you read the collapse of the financial sector in the US, once the main thing change has been raised is the problem of what's called the revolving door of people moving from the private sector right into regulatory bodies and vice versa. And that's one of the things that you could have seen that if we are looking at proper regulation in the industry, it's one area that we should be dealing with as and people are in the future. Why is it called revolving door? When people move in and out, and today they change the regulator, the next thing are out in the private sector and vice versa. So look, so it talks into the importance of those of us in the regulation. And lastly, I think both Chris from Corposatu and today, you are raising this question of the ownership of the Reserve Bank. And it always comes up, I always listen to people who are proponents of the nationalization of the Reserve Bank. I think I've got my own views on it. For now, there's no my views. But what I always find is that we always just put this statement without talking into it. That's the problem with the status quo. why is it wrong? Because if you are saying this business, it means obviously there are problems that you we are seeing in the current arrangement, right? And if I were to give a fair advice, that when you make a statement, I think you should sort of try to educate us and public as to what is the problem with the current arrangement. I think those are my few comments, Chen.
Right, over to Kosatu. Let's start with SDC, please ask more questions. Kosatu, then Momo, and DC, and then we round up.
Sure, we can do this, Chair. thanks for the questions, Comrade Chair. In terms of... Sorry, this mic. Yeah, in terms of the role of organized labor in civil society, now, as far as that, Comrade Chair, has been around for the cost of financial regulations, of course, subcommittees, working groups. That may be a good, useful working platform for organized labor specifically those unions in the banking sector who have got expertise. But also I think obviously you can find that in civil society there's a lot of expertise that is kind of accumulated on behalf of consumers, which are also useful to have it. The motivation is based sort of around different other civil society authorities and governments largely, where there's a specific role allocated to civil society. Certainly that's one point. But actually I think also you're saying it's also useful to specify when there's consultation that's specifically consultations is geared for organized labor for society. I do agree with you, Commissioner, that the bill is largely aimed at assisting the poor and hence we're supporting it. I think the Honourable Member, I think was related to that concern correctly. Look, I think there is significant improvement in this bill around the second balances. Our suggestion was to aim at how to further strengthen that in the interest of consumers and workers. Probably there's a merit in our suggestions. I think last time we said it's a bit as if they in opposition, we're not really in this field, but we're making it so we don't want an opportunity to kind of share our 20 cents of thoughts with members, so we see the opportunities. Currently the result is largely aimed at dealing with inflation through support, because inflation hits the poor the hardest, and they can least afford it, but we also think it must be expanded as it's still still, and also useful expansion of the reserve bank's mandate, which we support. But I think Chair also we support it being expanded towards issues of job creation, of job protection, saving of jobs, as we saw in African bank interventions. We think that's really added to the Reserve Bank mandate, so that's one problem. But I think the Reserve Bank is a public asset, it's the bank for the entire nation. It's a composition principle to have it, having private shareholders, be it somebody, I don't know, the family you're mentioning, I'm sure there's a Rothschild or which family it is. I know there was one German shareholder who was jumping up and down when the Reserve Bank AGM. But look for us, it's not a private bank, it must be owned by the state and the public at large. We must have a very clear progressive development on it. I'm not saying it must account to Momo on a daily basis as an office. I'm not saying it must be that, but to get the right balance. So I think that's basically our position. It's a public asset. And it's an accurate of history that's been allowed to have this kind of weird shareholder position come as chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair. Indeed, I'll just pick up from where I think on his last point. And Chair, with regard to the question raised, unfortunately, I will have to disappoint the member who has asked the question because I'm going to give him an academic or textbook kind of explanation of control. But simply to indicate that yes, indeed, Mr. Matthew has just alluded to the Rothschild family and originating from Germany and now located in the UK. And you have to ask yourself, what's the big deal in owning shares in the Central Bank of Lesotho, which is one of the over 100. If it is not about total control, which is firstly, just to have said the other question was about a request to us to perhaps explain exactly what you mean there. The Rothschild family also owns the largest, one of the largest news agencies called Reuters. they decide what is news, what he should know or should not know. Because of their definition of news and that kind of thing. And in the end, as we know very well in South Africa, there are so many people in South Africa who say, we never knew what happened in the apartheid era. We never knew what happened in the conflict. Because of course, the news that they received were selected specifically so as to influence how they think. I have to leave it at that in terms of what we mean here. And of course, also the question around ownership of the Reserve Bank and private investors, the questions are very clear, even with the almost representatives that are here. Because indeed, at the end of the day, the question has to be asked, in whose interest do you do what you are doing? And if it is to advance the process of ensuring that you know, certain companies or private companies can continue to make profit, it is in that context that the interests of those who are poor and cannot afford come last. We will deal with them as and when perhaps we want to outweigh our consciences and the like, and so on and so on. So, the questions also about, yes, what do we mean? so that these you know, companies can continue to make a big profit. And also for us to explain what our understanding of what the bill says with regard to what we understand as providing for more bailouts. The basic intention is, as has always been the case, to be able to say we have a very well-regulated financial system and so on. But look at it another way. Right now, we have, since legislation was passed for the creation of cooperative banks, we have had only about three being registered. In fact, the last one was somewhere around December last year, after all of this period. Simply because we think that it's our view that it's not an accident because when you create these high standards and these high requirements, only those who can attain those standards and for instance you know pay the kind of deposits that you need to have a banking license leave out other people or certain players within the economy. So that's the view that we take. And for instance, our reference to questionable practices of, for instance, funeral parlors is in the context of the insurance requirement insofar as where you have to sell insurance. Speak about the need for fit and proper person. That fit and proper person requirement in itself is such that in fact many people find themselves being unable to actually become fit and proper persons as the description says. So they'd rather do things in what you would call illegally or in the dark. Okay? But they do that because the people come to them and they look to them and say, well, if my relatives die, can you bury them for me? That's how the people approach them. It's got nothing to do with whether or not they are insurance people. I said, okay, if you give me so much a month, I will make sure that dispute on adults or he. So, perhaps Chair is only one example. There are many other practices beyond just female parlor operators, which stem out of practices that people find themselves in and just want to improve their situation through doing that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Right, Candy, and then Momo. I think, I subscribe to a particular theory that I don't present necessarily in Parliament as my political beliefs, but remember that I carry the mandate of creating a balance in society. The responsibility of creating a balance is to make sure that we serve all members of society equally. There's equity, there's fairness and so on. That's the basic thing I can disclose for now. But I need to pursue to explain to me, you know, a particular former state president once said that a virus cannot create a syndrome and created a lot of debate in society. So today we have not clarified as to what is the mechanical and ideological and intellectual discussion that surrounded that debate that seeks to assist any virus that lives in the bodies of individuals and people continue to die. So yeah, you say to prevent what you call source control. So I wanted to juxtapose that control to what we're dealing with so that we move in time the duty of it or at least understand what we're trying to tell us in this context of legislating or regulating the financial sector. Because people view it open-ended and want to persuade us because we're here to persuade us to believe and to accept your views. We will at least need to move with you in understanding. So I was not necessarily suggesting that you give me a scientific textbook definition, but at least to highlight, and because you see, other than Simona, I started with Peter Kamona, like Kamona, and that's it. Other than that, Peter Kamona, Peter Kamona, Oscar is a Peter Kamona, he's a man, the role of small business generally into this industry that is so well protected and secured and so on, and how we play into that space to harmonize the environment. So in terms of that, like I said, I think it's a little bit of 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 a little bit
Thank you. very briefly.
You can speak into Sutu, but we need a translator. So can somebody.
If I had the whole day, I would love to actually elaborate a lot, but I'm sure the honorable members here and everyone else in the room got a whole lot of other things to do hereafter. And Sandy, if you will allow me to, if you would allow me to.
Well, don't stop you and Sandy from sitting here till about 11 o'clock. Nothing stops you here, right? Alan will be here.
Well, if you were to allow me simply to briefly try to put it in this manner, that for instance, when you speak about cultural control in this case, in relation to the bill and the financial sector in particular, the fact is we are made to think in certain paradigms. And we are then expected to view things only according to that given paradigm. It comes across in so many different ways and so on. Says that if you think outside that paradigm, then no, it won't work and it's wrong. And it's only done this way and this is the only way. I can even dare put it in the most extreme fashion. That says you can choose any color you like as long as it is blue. So for instance, let me try to also then put it in strict, in our experience with regards to the financial sector, and the FFCC in particular. We raised the point years ago about the need for the banks to extend home loans to what today is called the gap market. The first reaction is, no. Why it will be expensive for the banks to do, it will be very risky, which is why the gap market exists. We're not sure whether they will afford, and so on. Okay. We are then, our thoughts are then channeled in that particular direction, and the likelihood is that we also then accept. We are within the FSCC working on researching in the modest way, and we have the means that would be necessary at our disposal to research. And what we are finding since through the financial sector charter council, the bank then accepted to provide gap loans loans to the gap market through in return for BEE points. Now there is evidence that is emerging that the loans that they have given to the gap market in that way are in fact as good as any other. They are seen to be making good business, as it were, even though good business still goes along with to mitigate the risk. This risky loan has to have a high interest rate and the like and so on, because otherwise the bank will collapse if the poor are not charged more. Okay. I can give you another example, for instance, with the cell phone industry. When it started at the beginning, the concept and the model was one of because the poor are risky, you can't give them contracts. They have to be on prepaid, okay, and then they get paid on, they get put on prepaid, which charges more than the contract person. And now today, with time, everyone realizes that actually the same cell phone companies are making more money out of prepaid than they are in product. Okay? Most of the money in it is from the law. Okay? So we are then made to think in a given paradigm, and it is then created in the DNA all. And this comes in many different ways to us. Of course, the media being the first, the television, the new agencies, and the like, and so on and so on. Thank you, Chair. I hope you have been
attentive. Okay, can I round up by saying, one moment, reply briefly, and then we're going to move on and tie up.
Chair, can I start with something that's not in the bill, which is the whole issue of the reserve bank? I think much has been said, but let me point out, the Reserve Bank, although it was established before, there are specific provisions in the Constitution, I think it's section 23, so on, which kind of clearly outlines what it does and in whose interest it acts. I find it incredible that anybody would say that the SARB doesn't act in the public interest. The fact that it has a shareholding structure is a fact of its establishment decades ago. I forget the date it was established. There was a model setting Swiss banks, etc. A few central banks had this model. But a few years ago, we in fact put in legislation because there were one or two troublesome shareholders who would come, even came to this committee when we were doing the amendments, and we have all kinds of conspiracy theories. They frankly have absolutely no impact on policy on the central bank. There's a monetary policy committee, it's well known who the people are, and I think the whole issue of how you move, given where we were, to move towards full ownership, what it will cost us, there's obviously, you've got to do it in a way where there's full compensation, so there's issues like those that come up. But I think that we can say with all the confidence in the world, no shareholder has any impact on the policy and approach taken by the SARB. To the extent that the SARB is involved in bank regulation, it is involved as a prudential regulator. And yes, there I do joke. I don't trust the brother of a central banker when it comes to market conduct. That's why we've got a market conduct regulator. But you've got both coming to operate. I think to try and suggest that the central banks are paid and so on, you know, there are issues where there's confidentiality and so on, and all of those need to be looked at. And it doesn't help to make vague statements like those. I think let's be specific. There are areas where there's opaqueness. Some you could argue. There are others that may not be necessary, but let's be specific about those issues. So, but look, the bill doesn't deal with the SARB as in how to establish the shareholders, but I want to remind members, we introduced a panel to even have fit and proper shareholders, directors of the bank. So, and you will have noticed the AGMs of the SARB are no longer as exciting since the new law came in and sorted things out, I think. Okay, with regard to the areas of bank regulation, yes, the SARB is there as a prudential regulator. I think that the areas of bank failures we've got within this committee, I know Honorable Kutalesi has not been part of the committee. Certainly over the failure of African Bank, there was even amendments to the Bank Amendment Bill. And the one thing you realize, there is great moral hazard with banks. And yes, regulators will always need to regulate as well, but they're not God, they are failures. And some bank failures, if they're not sustained, certainly should be allowed. But the issue is, on the lady, I don't know if you've heard the term SIFI, which means systemically important financial institutions. It's become part of the jargon after 2008. And so when the regulators look at that, they look at systemic risk that you face and how do you deal with it. And of course, we must hold our regulators accountable that where there is a failure, there needs to be some independent work to assess the reasons of failure. I can tell you that I know that the Mybert report, the SARB today has announced, that they intend to release it on, I think it's May the 12th. So they've just given notice. So that in fact will be happening, and that will take us step towards explaining some of the issues. I think with regard to the issue of lending, to I think yes, you to the extent we live in a mixed economy, and there is a particular paradigm that operates. Your banks actually are, and I say this advisedly, I know I've been taken up, but banking is like the nuclear industry. It's highly, highly regulated. You have to regulate almost everything around you. And for those who don't know, if you do not regulate properly, there are consequences when banks face some overseas regulators. They face fines. If it's money laundering, they have to do it. If we're not going to be tough enough, the overseas regulators are going to force us to, as we would do to other overseas institutions that come there. If their standards are not high enough, you can't allow them to come in and, in a sense, infect the system. Those are just issues of the way the world operates. Having said that, I think we also need to ask questions. I don't think you want the poor just to get loans which they can't afford. That's why the National Credit Regulator has issued new regulations with regard to reckless lending. And certainly, these are issues that we need to look at carefully. And of course, when people borrow, the last thing you want, particularly poorer people who borrow do, is to borrow for consumption. You hope it's for your house, etc. We cannot just say there aren't issues. There are issues of market conduct, who get the loans. We need to do these impact studies. And to the extent that there's a gap market, I think the sector could easily point the fingers at us as well, because I think when you deal with housing, there's many failures. And if you want to be honest and deal with it, let's look at the entire picture and let's look at it honestly and deal with all the issues, whether it's land that's available by municipalities, whether it's banks lending to poor. I think one needs to look at all of those issues. I think this bill just lays the basis to make sure that customers are treated fairly. There is another paper that we are coming out with this year, which is on financial inclusion, because that is a critical aspect. Are poorer communities or are there sectors that are excluded structurally from the system? If you remember, in the early 90s, there was redlining done by banks, where they didn't lend to areas like Soweto and so on. They were almost by definition seen as high risk. Those issues have been sorted out to some extent. But certainly these are ongoing issues that one needs to monitor and look at these issues. On the issue of, I think, issues of revolving door and so on, I think those are important issues to raise. And yes, something we need to look at to the extent that, in fact, I must say though, given the pay levels, it's very rare people come from the private sector to the treasury or to the regulator. The traffic is often the other way. Even to the south, it's the other way. It's not the doesn't come to us. But those are issues, I think, that are important to look at all stages so that there's no capture, certainly, of regulators. And the regulators are to use a language always intensive, intrusive, and effective. I mean, that's become the jargon, and I think we need to weigh each of those words and make sure that actually happens. Mm-hmm. I think with regard to the issue of fragmentation, we've got the combat. Let me say that even in whilst issues are resolved, certainly on the role of the credit regulator, we must understand every time there are different regulators, there is scope for arbitrage. It would apply even to medical schemes. And there are risks, and I think on these things one mustn't take an ideological approach that this regulator might be separate or not. I'm just saying at all stages we need to understand is our regulatory system as effective, intrusive, and intended as it should be, and how we're dealing with regulation of arbitrage at all stages. So one should look at these things objectively, and we should look at the evidence as and when arrives. It may not be an issue for the world now, but it's something, even as we implement two peaks, or Rambo said it's not two peaks, yes, okay, the new system, I think it's important that we ensure that it's as effective as possible. I think this on the issue of funeral policies, because I think those are really important issues. Many ordinary people, the poorest of people. In fact, when you look at the insurance, yes, we're just correcting with Jonathan. People buy funeral policies are number one in terms of volume, right? Mm. Is legal insurance number two? Credit life, okay. And those are where you have bigger views. Now, part of it is that, as I said, the entire chain is not regulated in one place, but I don't know if Jonathan or Kathy wants to say something, because I think there's been important questions raised. And of course, there's the extra service of type of coffin and so on. So, and that gets regulated differently, if at all. So, our deputy registrar of long-term and short-term insurance.
Yeah, I think just to say very quickly that those are very important issues that we're looking at, and they've been dealt with specifically in the insurance bill, which was also tabled in January, specifically for bringing a micro-insurance framework, and also to provide for ways that we can deal with informal funeral parlour operators, to try and bring them more into the formal sector, you know, and deal with the, exactly the sort of disincentives to formalise that were mentioned. We'll also be dealing with credit life issues together with our colleagues from the DTI and the National Credit Regulator.
Right. The last issue I was going to say, and I think your point on certainly the demographics this morning, I should just add, the trading has no role in the choice of
conference.
It is done currently in a different way. But it's not just Bafra, it would be obviously all the different industries.
Is this an observation? We can't prescribe to industry, but 20 years later, please. Okay, can we go on?
Well, sorry, I didn't have my mic on. Right, look, can we round up now? First thing, you need to acknowledge that we also have submissions from Asita. By the way, let's welcome Sheila Bhatta. She's the president of this movement, talking about now. She's sitting there at the far end. She's come to monitor Tandi's behavior, the young people in the movement, and ensure that the past interests of the Vanguard Party are represented here. She works by the parliament. But we welcome Sheila. Asita has given us a written submission, right? And we will put this into your grid, right? And we've got JSE writing up a page, which all of you have. And we've got now from the SACT something. It got here at what time?
It's from you.
You came in and meet in something.
You
came in and meet in something so late. Right? So the party, you know, it was promising to come to the last 6 weeks, and only now, and I think 11:15 or something, send it submission. So the phase one of the submission is ending today, which means we will, later down the road if necessary, we will actually allow a further round of submission if need be, and then those stakeholders have a strong interest, they can come to the meeting, because I see you can come from, you can sit any time of the meeting. So we'll see how it goes. The way we normally process the book. So we've got three written submissions today. At least at JSE and SAD. I just wanted to see if we overlap a lot with the financial sector coalition. Having said that, I would like to make a proposal, a suggestion, but I'm the woman who holds the people to Cape Town, and Roy hasn't said a word. But given that it's now 22, and you've got a 4,000 word presentation, and members of parliament, well, if you could have a very short-term memory. We're going to come back in August. Why don't we defer presentation? You're going to the first page. It's not easier, so you're thinking of the first page. Yeah, right? So now, I'm suggesting we postpone the actual inputs we're going to make. I'm going to be able to. Otherwise, you can do the 20 minutes in time.
Yeah, so we don't have to go through it. Maybe Roy can just say a few words if he likes. But what I was going to say is that, and just to help, you were asked about how is the trade responding. What we don't like to do, Chair, is to meet with the ombuds and then give them, you know, and only them, whatever these changes that we put in the next round of the bill. we have got a bill which has taken into account a lot of the issues. We'll need to update for just today's conference and you. But I think if the and we wait, we are aware that it is local, not ours. Okay. So, but we could publish in two weeks. A revised book which can show the, having heard all the concerns, this is how we propose to change it. What that will do, Chair, so even whilst you're not in session, you can put it on our webpage so that it's available to everyone. We don't have to just give it to one party, as I say. And that allows us then to have a more meaningful consultation with others also before August, because they still have problems they can, and some people may still have problems they can come and raise it. But it means that when we come in August, at least there's some proposed changes. What we've given out today, I think perhaps we just treat as your, just for your holiday or non-holiday. Whilst you're not, after May 18th, when you are campaigning hard for local government elections, yeah, that you can read those if you're so inclined. But Mr. Roy wants to say a few words and earnings.
Say something.
To say you can
it's not a fruitless expenditure.
So what I'm going to say is I completely agree with Mr. Quindle. I think that the submissions today have had regard to that wording changes and stuff. So we would just like to give Jay a chance to see those words.
I think the comment is funny. I like that. It will save us a lot of problems as well. So, you know, I think they should go ahead and do it. I've really experienced this in the years of the 1980s. It's a very original idea that, you know, you republish it, although the bill is in Parliament. I think it's James, there's no need to make sure. It'll be sanctioned, right? And he would encourage the others to write that stuff. I think it's good. Whether it's just a nominally, it's like, impress us and, you know, but they don't really need to change it. You know what change is like, and you know what we're like. That's a nice way to leave for discussion. But I want to use a more electric. I think it's good. And we want to be open and transparent. It's not just people who turn off the key from the United States. Well, what we're going to be careful about is starting another round of it. Yeah. So what I think we agree is that they will make written submissions to you, which they will also simultaneously get to Parliament, maybe we will send it to other meetings. You can send it to you, you can send it to Alan, and Alan can send it to. And then you respond to what they say. So we don't need to have a hearing unless you're in the field otherwise. For now, there's no second subtle square one. So I really like the idea. Anybody objecting to that? Very good. Good. That's done. A little announcement. The minister has written to the speaker, as he's allowed to say that the first test plan will not be ready by the time we sit on the 18th. I have discussed with Cindy that the report to Parliament is, yes, to submit the site plan together with the commissioner or explain why it's not done. So we will confer with the Treasury on the matter. It's with the Speaker's office right now. But there's nothing stopping us from bringing the quarterly reports. In other words, Treasury's report on its quarterly report. And on SAE, I wait to hear what the final outcome is, but we also want their annual reports and annual financial statements of this. So we have set up a NANCO meeting at 1:30 today, but what Alan tells me, nobody is available. People on leave and are not available. So I will, in the meanwhile, come with some proposals which I'll bring you next week on how we manage the rest of this quarter. And proposals that I think we agreed on, which is that the first month when we come back will largely, apart from the quarterly report from Treasury so far, will largely be on this of the FSR. Can the NC study group members just be in going back for 10 minutes at most? It's now before 1 o'clock, we'll all then be here for 13:00, so we can be here for 10 minutes. So, NC members will stay here. Thank you. Thank you.